Whatever became of Muir Wolf and Archie? My name is Richard Lamparski, and I think I'll let my guests introduce themselves.
I'm Stannis Ortega. I'm John Gibson.
And they were Muir Wolf and Archie, respectively.
Right.
Very well-known names. I remember very well, because you got a star billing in radio. A lot of actors didn't do that, did they? You know, they would say at the end who played what. And...
Well, because that's not as far back as I can remember. At that time, I think there were quite a few that got billing. It was quite a common thing, don't you think so, John, around that time?
Yes, I remember getting billing quite often, and it didn't mean a thing.
I don't think it meant as much in radio as it did in the theater or in the movies. Mm-hmm. People didn't remember who played even their favorite characters. I'm cursed with total recall, so I remember it very, very well. I was flattered to find that Mr. Gibson was a fan of this program. You must tell them what happened and how you bought the radio.
Oh, yes. I tried to locate this program from just what I'd heard about it. Finally had to buy an FM set to get it, and then couldn't find the station. But I finally got around to it, and I've enjoyed it ever since.
I get the two characters confused, and a lot of people do. The fat man as opposed to Nero Wolf. Can you?
Yes, I think I can explain that. As a matter of fact, Nero Wolf was on the air before the fat man. And I think the fat man was a logical following after Nero Wolf. Because Nero Wolf had some success because it was Rex Stout's stories. And I was not a fat man, certainly not at that time, or am I now? But I was the original fat man in the sense that he was a big man because he used to open the program with the signature of a wheeze. And then, of course, his difficulty in speaking, of course, was always searching for breath. And this, of course, made him fat, at least we thought so on the air. And we continued doing so for quite some time.
Talk like he did, Sandy, can you?
Well, we start out, the original signature was something like this.
I want to, Archie, explain to you just what his association with me meant to him.
Well, that's wonderful. I remember that so well.
Sandy standing at the mic is thin and trim, you know. And you close your eyes and you see this enormous fat man.
I remember so well your pronunciation of Archie.
Oh, yes.
That was
yeah.
drawn out.
Yeah. Well, that series, of course, went on for quite some time. As in the books, Marty was his leg man and his boy, and he was...
Not Marty.
Archie. Archie, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm turning that into something later which came out of Nero. And Nero sort of resented Archie's proclivity for girls. And as you know about the beer and the,
orchids
and so on. But he did like to have his boy to himself. Well, now, later... When Nero went off the air due to some royalty squabble, I don't know exactly what that was. And High Brown came on with another series called The Affairs of Peter Salem. Well, Pete, of course, was another fat man. And Marty was the counterpart for Archie. But Marty was a great girl getter, too. But the difference in Nero and Peter was that Peter would end up taking the girl away from Marty. So that was the difference, actually, in their characters.
Now, Jack Smart played the fat man, right?
Jack Smart played the
fat man. Is he fat?
Yes. Uh-huh. He was fat. He's since passed on.
Yes, he was quite fat.
Yes.
What are some of the other radio shows you did?
Well, I did Ellery Queen. I did Inspector Queen. I originated Inspector Queen and Ellery Queen.
That was Ellery Queen's father, as
yes.
I remember. That was on, I remember, Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine.
Yes. I thought it was a fine power show. At least it was for me, because the character of the inspector had so many facets, so many sides. Of course, course, when they cut it down to half-hour commercial, well, it was quite another thing. You couldn't get all those things into it because, after all, your star and your hero, Ellery. Well, you always felt with someone with a stuffed shirt for that type of point. So, then I did Charlie Chan after Ed Begley. I did Perry Mason. I did Bulldog Drummond.
Why were you chosen for all the detective roles?
I don't know. I'm not a detective fan reader. I really don't know. It's got all these different things, I suppose. I was accepted for one. I thought, well, he can do the other. I suppose that's the way it happens.
Sandy, did you ever figure out how many radio broadcasts you'd done?
No.
I did one time.
Really?
For a story, and it was amazing. It was an average of more than one a day for many years, and it came to something like 10,000 shows from the early radio days up until radio was practically out of existence in the dramatic line.
How far do you two go back in radio?
Well, I go back to the early 30s in radio.
I did my first radio broadcast in 1925. We did a full-length play, and then they filled in with a violin and cello the rest of the evening. It was from a small station in Oakland, California.
Did they have sponsors in those days?
No. And very few listeners.
Well, that's true. But I was thinking, of course, when there were sponsors, you know, the networks had a number of dramatic programs and things of that sort. I had done other broadcasts before 1930.
Oh, yes.
But, I mean, in a regular series, as a matter of fact, the first series that I ever did was with Julius Anderson and Frank Crummett, called The Blackstone Plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And on that, I played the part of Don Rodriguez. That was rather an odd thing. How I came to get that part? It was not that I had a Spanish dialect or I'd ever done a Spanish dialect before. It was just that my name, of course, being so Spanish. But one of the casting directors said, well, certainly this guy ought to have a Spanish dialect. And so I was there for it. And I was called for it. And I auditioned. And having been to South America, I think I spent about 8 or 9 months in Caracas and Venezuela. I said, well, I'll do what I heard there, and I did, and I got the part.
I don't remember that particular show of Crummett and Sanderson, but they had a very successful quiz show, I remember, during the 40s, I guess, called The Battle of the Sexes. And the men would be up against the women answering questions, and someone always asked her to sing. And she always sang, they didn't believe me. It seemed every week she sang the same thing. They would interrupt the questioning that long.
The girl from Utah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, she was a big star.
Yes.
I guess he was, too.
Yes.
Are they both dead? I think so.
I don't know about Julie. I know Frank is. He had been a shepherd of the lands for a number of years. But he passed away some time ago. I don't know about Julie. If she's still alive, I suppose she's still living in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Did either of you begin in Chicago, your radio career?
I didn't. No.
Because that's where a lot of the radio actors seem to come from.
Mine was all California.
Well, of course, I was a native New Yorker, and a native New Yorker.
Mm-hmm. Well, I came here in 1939 and went right on with radio, but prior to that time, everything had been West Coast.
Were most of your shows at that time done live? I mean, in the early days?
Yes.
Yeah. When did they begin recording?
Well, actually, I did a series. The second thing I did in radio was with Jimmy Gleason and Bob Armstrong, sponsored by an oil company. We made a travel series, sort of a comedy travel series, on what we call wax platters. And, of course, if you fluffed anything, you started it at the beginning again. And that was about 1930. We made maybe a couple of hundred of them, or five a week.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you remember a radio program that several people have asked me about, and I just know the name of it. I never remember having heard it. It was The Sisters of the Skillet.
Yes, I remember.
What sort of a program was that?
Well, it was a comedy. It was a comedy team. Two men.
Two men played the sisters.
Ralph Duncan and what was the other chap's name?
I don't remember. I remember Ralph very much. I don't think I ever heard it. Was that Chicago or New York?
I don't know. I have an idea they came out of the Midwest. But Ralph came on here later and became an actor on the stage here.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, I don't know. Ralph may still be a bit of a guy.
I don't know.
What, do they play women?
No,
it was called The Sisters of the Skillet. That's why I couldn't figure it out.
I don't remember it except for the title, and I don't think I ever.
Thinking back to some of those shows, you know, I think of the things that should still be on there, such as Vic and Sade.
Yes, that was wonderful.
I get more mail about Vic and Sade than any other actor or program that tops them all.
That was a classic of Americana.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it was a great...
And nothing much happened, ever happened.
No.
But it was so human and so close to us all that I suppose we all enjoyed it.
I was so grateful for radio, and yet I was never a radio fan. And I have never, to this day, heard Amos and Andy.
You've never heard them?
Never heard them once.
How did you avoid it?
Yeah, because they were by the house, you know, on the avenue.
And you could hear it up and down the street at 7 o'clock.
One exception, I was on the program with them one time when they had a half-hour show from New York for a while. And I did it one time. That's the only time I've ever heard them.
Well, I've always thought that Amos and Andy was great fantasy. But it lost out when they made it, you know, tried to give it a physical being. It was something else again, and never quite came up to what it was in radio. This wonderful fantasy. And
the television version, I mean.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't think it were on the screen.
No, they made two pictures, and neither of them were successful.
No, they couldn't. It was purely a vocal thing.
Isn't that funny, though, that you've never heard the program? Because I remember... I have a segment on Amos and Andy in my book, because they're both still, you know, living. They're not active anymore. And I said that on a warm night, you could walk down the street, at least in my neighborhood.
Yes.
Windows would be open and doors open, and you could hear it like it was piped in.
I did, I'm sure. I heard it many times in passing. But I never sat down and listened to it once in my life, and I can't explain it. I had nothing against it.
In fact, I remember one particular segment of it, and I don't remember what year it was, but... it was when Andy was about to marry Madam Queen. That was one of the big things on the program. He never did get married, but then he didn't marry her, and she filed a breach of promise suit. Well, then the trial was. And people would leave work early, and we went downtown, I remember, to do some shopping one night, whatever night the store was open, and they broadcast it throughout J.L. Hudson Department Store, which is like Macy's here, on every floor. And I asked my grandmother about it. She said, people wouldn't come here tonight if they thought they were going to miss the trial, because this is the night lightning testifies, or whoever it was.
I'll tell you something that was tremendously popular. It was Jack Benny's program, radio program, during the 30s. Because I worked with him on another program, and we got along so well, he asked me to come over and do his show. And just being on his show one time, people kept calling me for other radio shows, and almost the same gag, almost the same things I had done on Benny's. Now, at that time, the movie theaters in Los Angeles, at least, had to stop the picture when his program went on the air and play it on radio for the half hour it was on. Otherwise, they wouldn't have any audience.
That was true also of Amos and Andy. Where I'm from, the Midwest, it was on the marquee, 7 to 7:15, Amos and Andy, and they would book the feature so it would end just before 7, and the other one would go on at 7:15. Did Jack Benny have Jell-O as a sponsor in those days, too? He had it for so many years. That was the one I always associate with him.
I think so, but I don't actually remember. I did several shows with him, and they were wonderful, except that Benny was a great worrier, and he always worried about me, because I was a newcomer. And he always judged you by the first reading, when we would get the scripts and sit around a table and read it. And particularly Don Wilson. If Don laughed, you were in. And I remember I got let off the show and replaced one time because it was a dull morning. It was a Saturday morning, and the show was on the next day, Sunday. And it was a gloomy morning, and everybody was kind of gloomy and depressed. Nobody laughed. And Jack sat there and worried. And when I got home, they called me and said, "You're not on the program tomorrow. One of the writers is doing it."
Well, that's happened.
Yeah,
you
know. Who was his vocalist when you were doing the show so often?
Vocalist?
Yes. Was it Dennis Day or Kenny Baker? That will date you now. Kenny Baker was before Dennis Day.
Well, I knew Dennis Day, and I think it was Dennis Day then. This was in the 30s. This was roughly around 1935, I think.
Oh, I doubt it was Dennis Day then. It probably was Kenny Baker.
Wasn't Kenny first?
Yeah, Kenny was before Dennis Day, but I don't think Dennis Day came in...
Maybe not.
...that early.
I don't remember.
I heard that Kenny Baker was retired and living, of all places, in Solvang, California. You know that little Danish community in California?
No.
It's a little community that's all Danish architecture, and there's a famous Danish restaurant. It's if you drive up 101, Highway 101, you hit it beyond Santa Barbara.
Well, now my stepfather is a Dane. I think he knows all the Danes in California.
Well, it's called Solvang, California.
How do you spell it?
S-O-L-V-A-N-G. I think this program is heard there. They can hear us in Ojai, so I guess they can hear us in... So if you're listening, hello, Kenny Baker.
You know, I always think of the success of Jack Benny Burns and Allen. Mm-hmm. Because they were great friends, as you know, through the years. And I'm proud of them. And they were the first ones to get on the air.
Uh-huh.
And I was doing an MC, and there was always something very nice about George Burns, because he was all... I worked in the skits, too, and did the commercials for cigars. And at that time, I was selling cigars to ladies, because the idea being to get the husbands of the women to smoke the cigars. And with the beautiful lady behind me, would do the cigar commercial. But I remember at that time, because they had a party, I mean, Burns and Allen, and he hadn't quite gotten underway. Jack Benny,
mm-hmm.
that time. So everything since then is always gauged to me by Burns and Allen, Jack Benny. Whatever he did followed Burns and Allen. But going back to this little incident about working in the skits, you know, they wanted to call me by my first name, but the advertising office didn't want it, and they wouldn't permit it, so that I never really had any recognition there. As Santos Ortega called me Sandy or something like that. They wouldn't let him do that. But he certainly tried. It would have made a big difference at that time, certainly in a money way.
Has either of you ever had anything really terrible happen to you on a live show? Coast to coast, you know.
On television.
On television, but not radio.
Yes, well, I did.
A few things in radio, oh, yes.
Yeah. I had my voice completely disappear. No voice at all. Nothing is coming out.
What show was it?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember. It was some NBC sustaining program.
How did they cover it?
I guess one of the other characters came in, but there's so many incidents mm-hmm. that you can remember at that time. I think there was a woman by the name of Constance Collier on the... maybe it's unwise to mention a name because I could be wrong on that. But anyway, this English actress in starting this particular program... NBC now presents then the name of the story. And then this one actress immediately follows. Well, just as they came on with the name of the story, she's supposed to start, she drops a script all over the floor. And someone immediately sticks another script in front of her. You see, if I have to read from that, and she says, "Now, now, I want my own. Pick up my own."
This went out over the air.
This went out over the air, and that was the start of that particular program.
I can tell you one thing I remember, that I lost 3 pounds during a half hour, just standing there. One night, there was a program, I think it was called Manhattan at Midnight, and I had the lead on it. I was on every page and every other speech.
There was a dramatic series,
yeah.
I remember that. Uh-huh. It was all at night, too.
And different story each week and different people. And this week I had a tremendous role, and I asked for a conflict, which I shouldn't have done. I had to miss an hour or two before the show went on the air, and the previous show was right across the hall. So I crossed the hall and picked up the script and went on the air. Now, they shouldn't have granted this conflict, because during the day when we were rehearsing it, we referred to Life magazine. And they said, of course, we'll have to get permission. And then they had asked permission, and Life had said no, and implied that they would be subject to suit if they did use it. And I didn't know about this, and my script still said Life. And I came in, picked up the script, and we went on the air. And one of the other actors refers to this magazine earlier. And, of course, I was intent on my own speeches, but... I thought he said People's Magazine, and I quickly looked at him, and then tried to, you know, point to this, and I looked in the booth, and the director was paying no attention to me, and I kept trying to bring people in, you know, because I had it coming up on a few pages,
And finally, when it came to the place where I mentioned it, I thought he said People's Magazine. I wasn't sure. I looked in the booth. I looked around. Nobody was helping me, you know. And finally, I thought, well, what do I do? So I said People's Magazine. And just as I did that, the director stood up in the booth and then pretended to faint. And then he came up throwing me a kiss. Realized that we were so close to a real serious...
Probably
thing.
Saved them a good many $1,000s.
I know when I weighed myself that night, I had lost 3 pounds.
I don't remember their sponsor, but it was on the same night as Bob Burns, the Arkansas Traveler. I don't remember what night it was, but it was after Bob Burns. It was...
You do have a remarkable memory.
Yes, I know. It's a curse at times.
But it is impressive.
Some things I'd like to forget.
When I've listened to this program, I've been very impressed with the things you remember. The details, they're fantastic.
There was once a producer, I'm sure you know him, John. I can't mention his name. And the agency. And on the dress rehearsal, he was very meticulous about what he wanted. Of course, rehearsals ran over and they went on. When they came to air, they hadn't quite completed the dress. And his assistant said, "You're 2.5 minutes over." So at that time, he said, "Well, buy 2.5 minutes more. For air."
Yes.
Because they're going to go on air. And that's actually a true story. Buy 2.5 minutes more.
Mr. Gibson, you didn't tell us what terrible happened to you on television.
You want to hear it?
Yes, please.
Well, I believe it was the worst breakup in history. And the man just passed away recently. I saw his name in the list in the Screen Actors Guild. Mm-hmm. I won't name him, but he was a rather elderly man and a very natty little man, and I liked him very much. And this was one of the Robert Montgomery Presents shows about, how many years back?
It's only been off, I think, about 6-7 years,
yes,
hasn't
not
it?
Not too long.
Yeah, it was on for a long time, though, uh-huh. Monday night.
And this was another case where I had the whole show to myself, practically. You know, again, every other speech and in every scene, and it was one of these tremendous roles. And this little man played my boss. And he... And I had a scene just before the end of Act One, or the break for the commercial. And then we had another scene following that. And that's all he had to do in the show. Now, these were nice little scenes, and I had enjoyed rehearsing them with him. Now, he was also playing summer stock somewhere at the time. And I suppose he was exhausted, and of course, elderly. And we started our rehearsals at 9 in the morning, and I never left the studio floor until after air, which I think it was on the air 9:30 to 10:30, I think. And so he was terrified at some last-minute changes. So when we got to our first scene together, he went all right for a few speeches and then suddenly went blank. And... we had 2 floor managers, and they both rushed in between the cameras and got close to him and threw him the cue. And he just still looked blank. And then I thought maybe because of his age he was deaf and had concealed it. So I went very close to his ear and gave him the cue, and he still looked blank. So then I realized he was nodding all the time. He just kept nodding. So I had to change the dialogue so that he could answer me with a nod. Well, it was pretty frightening to suddenly have the whole air to yourself. You know, you got a whole network. You can do anything you want, and anything will be better than just standing.
NBC, from coast to coast.
Yes. So I did what I could, and I don't think I was too brilliant. But I did get through the scene, and I was to get rid of him. Ask him about a certain stock, I remember. And I asked him in such a way he could answer with a yes nod. And then I said, all right, you run along now. And then I had a little speech to myself at the end of the scene. So I got that far, and then we went into the commercial. Well, the director came out on the floor and took this little man aside and talked to him and said, don't worry, you know him. And then he came to me and he said, now, if he does it again in the second scene, I'm going to keep the cameras on you and, you know, good luck. So the next scene, I came into the office, and he was going through my papers on my desk, and I yelled at him.
And when I yelled at him, I realized he'd gone blank again. And so I did have a few minutes to prepare. But this was so bad, this night, that I had to go on from then and pace the show by instinct to get off the air at time. We'd lost so much time. And when it was over, I saw this little man standing over by the door, just looking terrified. And I went over and put an arm around him, and he said, "Oh, what I've done to you." And I said, "Oh, you haven't." You know, I tried to cheer him up. Then the director put on the talk back, and he said, "Everybody stay in the studio for the West Coast repeat, which was on tape. They were going to redo those two scenes so they could insert them for the West Coast repeat." And he couldn't do them then. And finally, the director said, "Hold the script," as though it were, it were business papers. And he still couldn't do it. He was so terrified, this poor little man. But I will say, to the credit of that show, about 6 months later, he was on it again, and he was excellent. I happened to see the program.
Wonderful on the part of the producer.
They gave him another chance. But this made all the papers and was considered at that time the worst breakup that had ever happened in television. We got calls from the West Coast everywhere wanting to know what was the matter.
I expect they hired you again, too, in a hurry. You were able to cover it that well.
Yes, they gave me credit for it, but actually, I wouldn't want to see it. I'm sure that it was pretty dull.
Terrible experience.
I've been talking with Santos Ortega, alias Nero Wolfe, and John Gibson, his faithful assistant, Archie. So thanks very much, Mr. Ortega, Mr. Gibson.
On May 3rd, 1938, a full-page advertisement appeared in all of the Hollywood trade papers. It suggested that stars such as Mae West, Greta Garbo, Marlene Dietrich, Joan Crawford, and Katharine Hepburn were box office poison. My guest next week is Mr. Harry Brandt, who is the author of that famous list. I'll be talking with him about his association now with Joan Crawford, who he now considers to be his friend. This is Richard Lamparsky. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll be with us again next week at the same time when we find out whatever became of box office poison.